message you first thing in the morning. This is Adam Barker. My name is Emma Battelle-Lohman. We are highly caffeinated Canadians. So we'll be coming at you with that mix of end of semester kind of tension and also extreme joy and over enthusiasm that comes from our colonial roots and our, you know, passion for being involved in this kind of event and these subjects. Adam and I are settler Canadian scholars from the overlapping borderlands of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe peoples. We grew up in this sort of southern part of the province of Ontario in Canada, which is the most populated area in the country. And it was our experience in that place and of that place and the things that we learned and didn't learn that kicked off a whole program of work and research that for us has led to about 10 years working together, writing together, publishing together. We're also married, just in case you see us being affectionate.
It's totally legal.
We've been together longer than we've been researching together, so just in case anybody gets uncomfortable. So we both work at the University of Hertfordshire. It's one of the post-92 universities just outside of London. Adam is in human geography. His research specializes in things like protest movements, indigenous resistance, and settler colonialism. And I am working in the history school, and I am a historian of 19th and 20th century North America, particularly the Pacific Northwest region, but particularly interested in indigenous research methodologies. And I'm picking settler colonialism as well.
So it is really great to see so many people who I remember from 2 years ago in 2016, and also a number of folks that I saw in Boston at the AAG in 2017. This is going to be a sort of an extension out of what you might have heard me presenting on at those two conferences prior. So the concept of carcerality is something that is relatively new to both mine and Emma's work, but we're finding it incredibly important in order to understand how settler colonialism actually works and how it functions. So Emma and I, from our ethical imperative, one of the things that we want our work to do is to contribute towards dismantling of structures of settler colonialism. And of course, in order to do that, we need to understand how they work. And yet again, that's in the complication of settler colonialism largely not telling you what it's doing or not making its functioning obvious to most folks. So we are left with a situation of trying to observe the various sort of stories about coming to belong, the ideas of what a place means within a settler context, and some of the histories of what has happened, but often recorded very much from a settler colonial perspective, and trying to reverse engineer some of the processes that have gone into making these places what they are. And of course, to do that, we have to disrupt the normalization of the settler colonial society a little bit, and carcerality has been a really, really important framework for doing that.
Mm-hmm. Now, North American roots in this, sort of draw on the work on settler colonialism that was developed out of Australia, particularly, that came from other disciplines. So it's already sort of an interdisciplinary kind of, or many-disciplinary kind of approach.
Yeah.
And working in contexts where the form of colonialism that is still dominant seeks to make itself invisible means this process of using tools like carcerality and tools for geography particularly to try and understand what's happening is absolutely critical. We've got to make these things visible so that we can then do the analysis and the work.
Right. So just doing a little bit of a review and recap of some of the things that you might have heard from me previously around settler colonialism and carcerality. My initial sort of use of the framework of carcerality applied to Turtle Island revealed what I think is a fairly contiguous set of spaces, some very much designed and intended to be carceral and very much displayed as such as prisons, and others with more sort of subtle forms of carcerality from the fairly overt residential schools, where once we start to discuss this as a space where, you know, bodies are confined and can't leave, yeah, it's fairly obvious that it's a carceral space. To far less obvious spaces, and this is where some of the counterintuitiveness, I think, of this conference really appeals to us. Whether we're talking about reserve spaces, which, as I discussed in that previous research, are often thought of as being set aside for indigenous people and communities, and one of the things of looking at the situation through the lens of carcerality is asking to what extent does the existence of a space like that also then fundamentally confine people upon it, because everything that's outside of that space is very much constructed as a settler space or settler colonial space. So we have these interlocking spaces that essentially comprise the whole of settler colonial space on Turtle Island. And the way that this research extended was to look at the idea of a carceral churn, or people being encouraged to move through these different carceral spaces in various ways. So no carceral space becomes a home. You're not allowed to belong in those sorts of places. You're constantly being shuffled along to the next place where you don't similarly belong until one of two things happens. Either bodily death and social absence, sort of that inability to actually have agency in society, eliminates indigeneity as a functional thing, along with the bodies of people who carry indigeneity with them. Or that the idea of this go back where you came from is this kind of constant bouncing back to whatever the previous space is. And so this inability to rest, inability to build a community, inability to gather sort of fundamental resources comes from being constantly shuffled through this carceral system. So this carceral churn was really important for our thinking, but we're left with this lingering question. This is entirely spatial, and we wanted to know what about time.
And that time consideration is really important because the kind of, the ways that settler academics, more sort of actually disciplinary, I should say, sort of in North America and other places, as well as into the practical sense, create both a spatial and a temporal othering and distancing. And this comes in from sort of my interdisciplinary history experience and in our collaboration, thinking through elements of how history creates its other, but also, of course, going back to the famous Fabian about how anthropology constructs its other, how there's at once an immediate presence because there's an interaction, and so there, in all of these areas of the carceral turn that you picked up on, there's an immediate presence. There's an administering of the reserve. There is, running care facilities, people organizing the prison. And at once that denial of coevalness, putting indigenous peoples constantly out of time. And we see this in formal ways and processes, and also some informal ones. We'll bring up some examples from our own backgrounds.
Right. So one of the first things that sort of made us think about, how time might fit with the carceral was Kevin Grenier. I'm not sure if anybody's familiar with his work. He wrote a great book called The Third Space of Sovereignty on indigenous politics in the United States and Canada, primarily the United States, but he extends his arguments to Canada quite a bit.
They're basically the same.
And one of the arguments that he makes is that settler people always perceive indigenous peoples to be out of place and out of time. Now, the out-of-placeness is pretty obvious. We were able to put our finger on that fairly quickly. But the out-of-timeness is a little bit harder to understand exactly how it works, how it's functioning, how that temporal frame is imposed.
It's easy to see in works of old anthropology.
Right.
It's easy to see in historical documents. It's easy to see in some of the relationships Canadians have to their myth. But it gets messy, really, when you try to unpick it in the present.
Especially because it gets caught up with all these sort of myths of multiculturalism, which are still relying on this sort of throwback to this experience of modernity that is, even as we talk about multiculturalism, it's multicultural modernity. There's this assumption that things are going to happen in particular ways and at particular paces. And that assumption about the time frame of modernity is something that people are meant to come into. You are meant to be pulled into that frame and then exist there. But there's no sense that frame itself is part of what's being imposed through settler colonialism. We're also inspired to think through the idea that the circuits of carcerality, those carceral circuits that have been such an important part of sort of rethinking carceral geographies over the last couple of years, come along with being built through circuits of capital as well. Those things go together. They overlap quite heavily. And so we also needed to consider how the construction of a capitalist political economy on Turtle Island was being built alongside this carceral system and the way that those two circuits might actually serve dual functions in certain senses. So Emma's mentioned time and the other, which is really our sort of our work that we rely on to kind of flip the lens and look about how, rather than there being sort of this creation of modernity in a vacuum, there's actually this relocation of a very capitalist-informed, state-centered, rooted in sort of enlightenment liberalist philosophy idea of time that's being imposed on the land. And the first ways we see that being expressed by settler people
in
the present is through this idea of there being something like as Indian time. So for those of you who aren't familiar, there's often this derogatory reference to indigenous people being late, or their meetings running too long, or people not showing up at the right times. It's always Indian time. Oh, they run on a different set of time than us. And it's often spoken in a very pejorative way, as if there's something wrong about that time, because it doesn't keep up with ours. It's not fast enough.
You may have seen, Canadians get a lot of praise for this internationally right now, for having a very handsome prime minister. So Trudeau/Trubeau, one of his less wonderful sort of press moments was being filmed, basically telling off a group of indigenous leaders for taking too long in their introductions, because they'd given shorter versions of what were culturally appropriate ways of introducing. And we saw there, in the very same way as Trudeau's father showed during the constitutional talks, a real sort of frustration.
This is taking too long,
yeah.
You know.
No, your time is wrong.
Right. So this whole project exists within a bit of a larger research framework, which we'll come back to talk about that project briefly at the end. But it's important to situate it in terms of a particular place. So
if we want to get into the specifics, so how, in a concrete sense, have temporalities and spatialities been mobilized in carceral ways to change indigenous and settler life ways in a place? I'm a historian. I want to get specific. Adam loves the big theory, which is wonderful. But we need to kind of bring those things together to really test it on the ground and see what happens. Because otherwise, we can come up with ideas that might be useful, but we do need to see what's the specificity. How did people fit or not fit into these ideas and processes?
Right. And so for us, we go right back to our homeland and the place where we have the relationships of responsibility that guide our work. And this is largely the place that we're looking at. So this is Southern Ontario, as it's called today. And it's the area in gray is what's known as the Haldimand Grant. So this was the area that was granted by the Crown to the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, who relocated from New York State in recognition of their allyship during the Revolutionary War, and the fact that they lost their homelands because the Americans came through and burned all their villages in New York State. So the original grant is absolutely massive. It follows the entire Grand River for its length. And what we see in the little orange blob there is what's left of the reserve lands today. So this is kind of the inspiration for our project, in that by right, by law, by treaty, indigenous people, and specifically the Haudenosaunee, should be able to range through and use that entire territory as much as they wish. And yet what's happened is the area that is actually for their use has been really constricted. And at the same time, all of the rest of that land, it's not sitting empty, it's been turned over to settlers. So there's something about what we're doing as well, which is creating this sort of collapsing system that becomes carceral. So I want to very briefly outline two examples that we found, because this is a very early stage of this research project. So we're just kind of getting this up off the ground. We spent two very brief trips in the archives in Southern Ontario in 2017 and 2018, and found these two examples that I think show different versions of the kind of thing that we're concerned with. So the first one is around the discussion of the centennial of Upper Canada. So Upper Canada is the precursor to the province of Ontario. It's founded in the 1790s. And there's this story about Lord Simcoe, the first lieutenant governor, going around Lake Ontario trying to find the site where they're going to put the first capital of this crown colony, which eventually becomes Toronto. And there's this, we found a book of speeches from the centenary of this, where these now members of the legislature are recalling and in fact mythologizing what was actually going on at the time. So they mythologized this canoe trip, because saying there were no roads and it was so difficult to travel around then, so Simcoe had to get this canoe and go and find all these different spots along the lake, and so he missed all of these potentially better spots, but the space that he found probably was the best one at the end of the day. And it's this very heroic narrative of Simcoe and how we get our origin story of Ontario at a time when it was wild and undeveloped, and now it becomes what it is.
It's very man be nature,
yes.
And very man be empty nature,
yes.
Which is weird because it was full of.
And we have, now historical reconstructions, but at the time, we already knew there were all sorts of Indian trails, never called roads, but very much functioning as roads, all through the territory that was being discussed. And the British knew this because they used these trails.
And wrote about them.
So in the 100 years between when this happened, and Simcoe actually did take some of the roads. Like, if you look at his own memories, or his own memoirs, rather, he took various roads at various points. Yeah, but what we've done is we've essentially erased an entire previous transportation network in favor of this new imposed one and created the narrative that there wasn't anything like that before because we need to control this pace of movement.
Even though one of the main transportation routes we still use is the old
it's,
road.
It's built right over top of that old road. So we're running low on time, so I'm very going to quickly just go through this example. So the Grand River, as I mentioned, is kind of the centerpiece to this Haudenosaunee territory, and something called the Grand River Navigation Company was created by the Indian Department of Upper Canada, with the idea of increasing commerce up and down the river. And so they used money that was actually belonged to the Six Nations, was held in trust, to basically build an ill-managed, corrupt, and completely sideways company that made all this canal infrastructure and then promptly went bankrupt and lost all of their money. And they've never been able to recover any of this. they also don't benefit from the transport infrastructure built on the canal that is the canal system, because it's largely just used for freight transport, which bypasses their economy entirely. So the six nations have lost out on their money at the same time as they've lost out in participating in this increased pace of transport and moving things around, meaning, again, they're being cut off from and denied activity within this larger political economy. So I know we've got to wrap up.
So we're presenting some ideas very much in progress, in part because getting situated in new academic jobs has kind of kicked our intellectual escalation.
Oh boy, lots of teaching.
Lots of teaching. But this is what we're going to, this is 2019. So 2019 is we want to work on this particular element about sort of incarcerality and mobility and these examples that we've been finding through the archives and through our travels through these spaces. But what Adam and I are envisioning is that this is a part of a much bigger kind of overarching project that we're going to call Corduroy Road. So corduroy roads, you may be familiar, they were a sort of early settlement transport technology. They were roads made through wooden spaces where you could just cut down trees and line sort of split logs so that you had something to take carts across. They are transient, they're not permanent structures. They're sort of built of the materials to hand and sort of out of necessity. They're not great, but they make a big difference. And we're looking at this as a sort of large metaphor for the things we're interested in, is the increasing mobility, the interpenetration of indigenous and settler societies and the dynamics of power. And we're considering things as well, like sort of how this continues to manifest in the present, but also the things that are no longer visible. We want to explore some good dead ends as well.
Right. So thanks. Sorry we ran over time. Sorry. Appreciate you being listening. We're happy to answer any questions about the bigger project if you wish at any point.
Or any questions that Kim gives us time for.
Yes.
Yeah.
We can just shuffle off stage now for the questions at the end. Is that all right?
No, stay
close. Stay
close. Thanks very much.
Okay.
I imagine what you're going to try and say at the end, there was something about how the Corduroy Road project